We have to make little adjustments on a certain panel, and then it will tell us what happened in 1066, providing we told it first. And the being who became completely choked in this manner with ideas would have no willpower. Now, we're doing this in terms of logic very carefully, so that we can understand all the psychologies later, and in particular Carl Jung at the moment, to see why things are repressed. Supposing this is an idea, I would like a motorbike. And supposing I am a little boy, age 12, and I say to my daddy, I want a motorbike. And daddy says, you can't have a motorbike because you're not old enough to have a license. Now, straight away, this presents me with a problem. Am I going to get that idea, I want a motorbike, and say, oh, well, I'll just leave it. That's a very funny kind of boy. He says, I'll just leave a thing that I want because I've been told I'm too young. What he does, in general, is start trying to grow up as fast as he can. And if he goes out and borrows the motorbike of another boy who is 15 and has pretended to be 16, then whenever he sees a policeman, he will feel in him a fear of possible capture. Now, at that moment, he has defined himself in his superficial personality as a boy 16. He knows very well he doesn't look a bit like 16, and he doesn't want to look like 12, so he takes the idea, I am really 12, and he pushes it down, and he pushes it into the zone of the pure will. And he there spreads it out until it occupies with its energy the whole zone. So we now have an idea which has been so spread out that we cannot see its edges.
And not articulated.
It is not articulated, no. Because articulation means a formal or mechanical relationship with other ideas. We've now taken the energy which rotated down, we've put it down there. It's still there, and it's still the same thing it was, namely, I know I am 12, but it's been spread out so wide that we can't see its edges. Now, there's another one down there that was a thing, I stole a pound of mincemeat last year and ate it in secret and had tummy ache. And I didn't tell Mummy why I got the tummy ache. Now, that idea was pushed in there and also spread out. So, covering the same area are two totally different experiences. And this is the strange fact, that we can push any idea by pushing its power out so far that all the ideas become related in a peculiar kind of identity of power, and yet they are still potentially what they were before we repressed them. We'll see how to illustrate this in another way in a moment. Meanwhile, what we have to be clear about is this. We have an ability to define form or idea by means of words. If we consciously use a word to say what we are doing, it is not down there. And if we consider the case of the congenital idiot, who, as far as he knows, has no ideas, as far as he knows, we know by watching him that he's got some ideas from his ancestors. For instance, when he was a baby, although he was an idiot baby, he still knew how to suckle. When he's grown up a bit more, he knows how to shovel the food in, he knows how to excrete, he knows how to breathe and so on, and he knows how to do other primitive things. And all of these are inside here for him. But to do the diagram for him, we would have to take the will line there and push it right up until it occupies the whole zone. And inside that will are seeping in from the collective unconscious the ancestral experiences which give him the ability to suckle, to eat, to excrete, to breathe, and so on. So, only in so far as we can employ terms correctly to define what we are doing, can we regain control of the elements below, which have initially been nearly defined, and because of their unacceptability in the environment, they have been pushed down. To get at those things below, we must learn how to tell ourselves the truth. And we can't do it unless we understand that an idea is a rotation of power or will. That we have no ideas whatever other than willed actions, either of ourselves or our ancestors, or the cosmic self, which we call God, or the absolute, which is a pure will, shot through infinitely with every conceivable and inconceivable form. So when we will a certain act, we commit ourselves to an actual behavior which has a definite form. So if I feel at the moment like having a little drink of tea, to fulfill the desire, I have to go through a certain behavior pattern. That behavior pattern has a shape. The hand is extended, and simultaneously a record is put in the mind. My hand is being extended, the cup is being lifted up. All these are forms of action. And as recorded in my mind, they are ideas. And as verbalized, while I am doing it, they are clear, conscious ideas. If we take Descartes or Spinoza or David Hume or Hegel or any of these people, we find that they distinguish their own growth by a growth in clarity, where they verbalize to themselves these urges and discover the essential pattern. There's a way where you can get a drink of tea and it goes in the mouth. There's another way where you get it and it goes on the tie. Now, it is very important to get just precisely where you want it, the tea. And in order to do it, you have to become very clear about it. You know, babies, when they start, they throw it all over the place. And if it weren't for the parents saying to them, not on the floor, not on me, in the mouth, over and over and over again, this would not be clarified. So that if we get a congenital idiot who's incapable of responding to the verbal stimulus, he still eats when he's 30, like he ate before. In fact, you'll find him on all fours eating the pile off the carpet if you don't stop him. This question of the word is tremendously important. Now, I want to say at this point that idea, if we look at it, idea, that's an old form of a goddess, there. And this I is the principle of existence itself, finite existence. This D is the division or analytical function, and air is the old form of the word, which in English we still use, air, earth. Air is an old goddess of the earth. Dea means same lady ploughed. That is the earth. Furrowed. Here is the implement which does it. I, air, with D, the functioning or the application of this instrument in the primal substance. An idea is an air, the original substance of the world, and an I acting upon it to furrow it or divide it. Like we said about the saw, one side is serrated, so the earth is serrated, and then we can count the furrows. An idea enables us, when it is clear, to see the true form of existence, and therefore to separate out those things which can be used from those things which can be useless in any given situation. And therefore we say of ideas they are intensely practical. To divide men into two kinds, the practical man and the man of ideas, is not really correct. A man that we call an intellectualist is a man who's so preoccupied with ideas that he becomes an unpractical man in the world, like a certain astronomer who was watching the stars and fell down a well. It's well known in history. And we must realize that for us, we cannot get the clarity of idea without a word. So we will now consider just precisely what this business of sound is. We said the person is the through sounder. Now, if we take the sum root, which is the root of summon, sonic, etc., sound, we put a U in there and a D on the end, that's the English word sound. Son itself means reverberations of spirit within an enclosure. This O is the enclosure. The spirit is transcendent and is cutting across that line and causing a reverberation inside. Now, that reverberation is called the internally speaking word in the universe and in every individual. When it says, be still and know that I am God, or be still and listen to the quiet inner voice, it is a reference to the sonic fact of our being. The mere fact that we are circumscribed and that there is power outside us knocking on our surface demonstrates that there are vibrations going on inside us, echoing backwards and forwards, vibrating and producing by their intersection form, which is idea. So, from the mere fact of existence, we know that every being is equipped with all the form of a sphere. We start as an egg, we are vibrating. Now, at one period, the scholastics and some others of their followers and some of the English philosophers said that man was born a tabula rasa, a plain sheet. Now, that is demonstrably false. And we can prove it from the egg and the way it develops. Supposing this represents an egg, and that egg is going to become an embryo, and that embryo is going to become a child, a youth, and a grown-up man. That egg is factually in an environment, and it is being battered by stimuli. It is not static, not rigid, it's like a jelly. Under the appropriate microscope, you can see it quiver. And by dropping little bits of lemon juice or something around it, you can produce tremulations of various kinds in it. Each egg from which an individual develops is already run through, shot through with form. So that before the embryo is formed, long before you become like a human being, you are already an egg saturated with universal form because you are an egg, a sphere. And the nature of this sphere is such that biologists would say it has irritability. It has the power to respond to a stimulus. It has its intelligence center, which if we cut out, the power to respond disappears. And with it, it is constantly reacting to the stimuli from outside. But the stimuli from outside, because it is a sphere, always produce inside it a rotation of the stimuli, and this rotation, for which we use the symbol of Mercury, Mercuri means the running of the substance inside that sphere. Every egg is already a mercurial system, or system of running form. Now this means that the tabula rasa, the plain sheet of the scholastics, is an abstract idea. It is not a concrete fact. No child is born with an empty mind. Every child is surcharged with form that physical science, genetic science, admits it in the genetic factors, in the chromosomes. There is form, but it still tends to think that the mind is free, whatever that mysterious entity might be. What we are showing is that in no sense is the egg free from form. So that already every egg is conditioned within itself by the fact of being an egg, by form, which form is possible to build into a highly complex structure, if ordered properly, of the self-conscious reflexive being. So we have here in a simple egg a being surcharged with form identical with the form in all other spheres, because every sphere must vibrate in a spherical manner, and therefore in every egg there is already factually a pattern, a vibrational pattern of universal wisdom. Now wisdom means only the form of the sphere. The dome, the whiz dome, whiz itself is the IHSV, the HWIS, is the name Jesus, Yoshua, with the H dropped off for individuals. We put the H back on if we mean universal. We take the H off if we mean individual. So we say wisdom for universal, wisdom for an individual. What wisdom is for an individual is the formal content of the dome or sphere of his being. We have to be quite clear about this. It means, in fact, that no two beings, starting from different eggs, can possibly be identical in all respects. And if no two beings are identical in all respects, internally, from the beginning, they cannot respond even to identical environments in the same way. This means that every individual, whatever, is unique from its origin. And that to try to treat with one educational system all those individuals in one way is necessarily to produce diverse results, because they've already got this different form of furniture. Now, when this egg begins to develop and set up its walls, each part still has the retained memory and ground of the whole sphere. So if we divide it into, say, a million eggs and take one of them, that little cell in the body is still an egg, still a sphere, and has still within it this wisdom. This wisdom is in every cell in the body. And it is because of this that each cell in the body will fulfill its function. It has wisdom, and there's a peculiar relation between all the inner subdomes of this big dome. This is just as much a diagram of the universal soul with ourselves as individuals within it, or of an individual human body with the little cells within its body in different organic groups.
Singer Sublife, I'd like to ask you a question at this point, which you asked before.
Yes.
Well, before you start,
you'd better go. Yes, I've asked you before. If we take the knife. Man as one of the small cells of the universe, and of the number of men, a small number, again universal consciousness. If we go then from the universe to individual man and regard him as a universe, is there a parallel? Can certain cells of his body gain a consciousness at his level? I did ask before, and I suppose I'm stretching this too far.
We can soon solve this by the number of parts internal to the body. You know, Christ said, we are worth more than many sparrows. You know, two sparrows sold for a farthing, and we're worth more than many sparrows. Now, it is a quantitative statement, isn't it?
Yes.
If we remember that the universe itself has some limiting factors, For instance, all chemistry is this side of the atom. It is only concerned with molecular relations. On the other side of the atom, the electron side, it is no longer chemical. You see, we use the word chemical for the relations between certain particles on the big side of the atom, molecular relations. Now, you can see that if a being is entirely simple, it cannot reflect on itself. Supposing we take the enlarged billiard ball, it's all ivory. Now, supposing that ivory is itself consciousness, what can it know? It can know only I. It cannot know I am. That's two. Am is part of the verb to be. If it is saying I, or ivory, you see, then already it has exhausted its possibility if it be a simple. So if we want to make a being that can say what God says, I am, then we have to say I am, I am. We must have a being with an I am there and an I am there, mustn't we?
Yes.
For a complicated thought, we must have a sufficient number of working parts. This is why we have cellular division in the body. You can see, therefore, that if the individual man within the universe, if that man has sufficient number of parts inside himself, superior to the sparrow, there's a nice sparrow, if he has more parts than the sparrow, in his nervous system, he can talk to himself because of that fact better than the sparrow can. Now, here is the man, and we know, because we are discussing our own origin, that in man we have sufficient number of parts to be able to discuss our own origin. If we remove some of the parts, like get a chopper and remove the head part, the discussion stops. Or if we scoop portions of the brain out, or even go as far as a frontal dichotomy or something, even that will interfere with our understanding of cosmic processes. So if we imagine that inside this individual man there is a cell, and we examine the cell under a microscope, it hasn't got enough parts to become aware of this big cosmic sphere. We have enough to be aware of that and aware of the constituent cells. The constituent cells have not got enough to be aware of this macrocosmic sphere. They haven't even got enough to be aware of us as a whole being, which we can demonstrate very easily. Because if we just nick a nerve in a certain position, which stops a certain organ from receiving messages from the other part, then it goes mad. It starts acting quite independently. May produce various diseases in the body because it has no concept of the being to which it belongs unless certain coordinating nerves send it messages all the time. So there aren't sufficient numbers of parts, sufficient complicated patterns in the single cells of our body to enable them to know that we exist. But in the case of a man with sufficient number of parts, I'm not talking about a congenital idiot at the moment, a normal man with sufficient number of parts to be able to define his terms, that man can think about his source. The Rhodesian man couldn't think about it, probably. The Piltdown man certainly couldn't. See?
Yeah.
You have to have a certain number of working parts before you can have a complicated thought pattern.
Yes, I see.
Thank you. Now, you know what we were saying about dividing the whole being into two parts, one for ideas and one for the will. Actually, the human brain is divided down the middle. And the normal person uses one half of the brain for thinking and so on, and the other half he doesn't use for thinking. The medical profession does not know what he uses it for. But really, he uses it for willing. It's kept empty of idea so that you can send energy from it into the idea patterns. Half of it is made into idea patterns, the other half is kept free of idea. So if you get damage in the left side of the brain, in quite large areas, it will not interfere with your thinking process, because it isn't used for thinking. All you'll be is deficient in energy for a bit. So one half of your brain is kept free of idea and supplies energy to the other half with which you think. Let's take the case of a man. There's his brain, there's his right hand, and there's his left. And the nerves from his right hand go to the left side, and the nerves from the left go to the right side. Now, the ordinary right-handed person is taking energy from the left side of the brain to the right hand. And the left side of his brain is empty of idea. So that when the energy comes from the left side into the right arm, it comes down uninhibited and very strong. So his right arm is stronger than his left. Whereas to get a message to the left arm, he has to put it through the thinking side. And the thinking absorbs some of the energy that goes down to the left arm, which makes it weaker.
This is reversed in the left hand.
Now, a very funny thing happens in the case of the left-handed person. All people should be right-handed.
Oh.
But what happens is this. If a person, by inhibiting the right side, say neutral very often, this nearly always happens in the case of twins, when they lean on each other in utero and restrict each other's movements. If this side is repressed, then energy that would flow to the right hand, not being able to get out and use it, flows through the thinker down to the left hand. You see? And then you find that the left-handed person is very cunning, because he never wills without thinking. That's why the Levites, which are the tribe left-handed, were chosen to be the priests class. Levi means left-handed. And if all the energy from your will first filters through ideas, it tends to go into the left hand. That will only happen if you inhibit on the right side first. And if you see very clearly that the number of working parts in you is tremendously important before you can reflect the universal sphere.
Would this suggest left-handedness to be beneficial in that case?
Well, you see, if it is imposed from outside, it may make that person tremendously and unnecessarily cunning.
Waste the energy.
He may be over-cunning, he may be in a simple situation. And he may go and analyse that simple situation.
Mm.
When another fellow, acting directly through, will snatch it from under his nose while he's considering it.
Mm.
What we find in the case of many stutterers is that they were of the order who had been restrained on this side, and therefore the will had fired into the thinking part, and the speech centres, which come into the brain at an angle like that, that angle, just over the centres of the sinuses, those messages are filtered through this side of the brain and are interfered with so that the will cannot work freely. And you know, if your will gets interfered with while you're talking starts going to bits. So we find very, very often, if we trace back the behavior of a child who is stammering, we often find that he's been pushed, although this isn't the only way, he has been pushed into stuttering by interfering with his natural tendency to express himself on that side and forced into the other side, so that he cannot spontaneously express himself. Everything has to be thought first, and in the thinking, unless it's efficient, it cuts it up and jumbles it and falsifies the pure message to the vocal apparatus.
That would mean if you try to correct, or rather change a person from left-handed to right-handed, it might produce stuttering.
Only if you did it unintelligently and by force from outside. I know lots of people who have been left-handed who have trained themselves consciously into ambidexterity. Not to lose what they got in the left hand, but to gain a spontaneous expression into the right hand as well. In fact, I know three people who have done that in the last 4 years. And they've found that they feel better balance, because they don't have to think before a simple act. And before, where they felt nervous, now they don't.
This would be a method of helping to cure the stammer, would it?
Well, of course, it has to be applied by individuals. Mm. And there are many schools of thought about the cause of stammering. And yet, at the back of all of them is this falsification of the direction of the impulse. So that instead of going through your vocal apparatus freely, it is interfered with, inhibited by a thinking process. One of the demonstrations is that practically every stammerer can sing without stammering.
Mm.
And the reason is the singing centre is not quite the same as the rational speech centre. Singing is very deeply related to your rhythmical centres and to your feeling, not to the merely logical side of your brain. So that the stammerer in general does not stammer when he sings, because he's using a different centre. And that itself is an evidence that part of the trouble is the logical thinking mechanism interfering with the spontaneous movements of the vocal apparatus.
That's the slowing, the slowness of the intellect dealing with a thing, whereas the action centre deals quickly.
That's right. Well, of course, you can prove that to yourself very simply by trying to run upstairs. Don't try it downstairs. Run upstairs, saying to yourself, I'm putting the right foot and the left foot down on each step. You'll find you will stumble or trip, because the logical part can't work quick enough to do it properly. Don't try running down, because you'll break your neck. Running up is bad enough.
I didn't get that this morning. I got to the top and said, I'll run down two at a time. I fell.
You thought you would.
Yes.
Well, you thought it, you see. That's the kind of thing you can only do spontaneously.
Mm. One of those boys that were in that the guitar group stammered badly, but sang all right, like that thing. But I mean, he didn't stammer.
Oh.
Did he play it for you, incidentally?
Oh, I didn't see him.
No, when did he play the recording we did of it?
He said you've got it over here.
No, she got it. Both of us took it back. Mm.
Speaking of that, a friend of mine was good at games. He had wonderful facilities for catching things and that sort of thing. He did slam, but very slightly.
Yeah.
Would you not expect a person with those good reflexes to have good speech reflexes as well?
No. Because remember what we said before about subsidiary personalities, about behaviour patterns. You can have one behaviour pattern that can do something perfectly, and another centre dealing with another thing may be totally false. Never think that you're dealing with one homogeneous, unific being, you know. You're dealing with a circle with lots of little circles inside it, all tied together, in general, in a very higgledy-piggledy manner. Plotinus said long ago that if we want to get to the absolute consciousness, first we must gain the universal consciousness and then take a jump. And what he meant was a very fundamental, simple thing. Here is an individual and there is another individual, and they have a conversation. And they say, well, you're there and I'm there and he's there. We're all there, so that's in common, our there-ness. Then they touch each other's bodies and say, we've all got resistance, and we'll call this resistance matter. We've got matter in common, there-ness and matter. Let's link ourselves together with the concepts there-ness, body, matter, and so on, there-ness, which we have in common. Then we look around and find some animals, they've got there-ness and bodiness, and some trees and stones and so on. They've all got there-ness, bodiness, resistance, matter. They're gradually building up, bigger and bigger and bigger, and they look out the solar system, the stars, you see. They built the universe empirically from within, going out, starting with little observations of sense and building bigger and bigger governing concepts on the ground that we have something in common. What we arrive at then is a big sphere which we call the universe. Now remember, we've said this before, universal is not absolute. The absolute is outside the biggest circle you can conceive. The biggest circle you can conceive is the limit of the universe. When Plotinus said, first get universal consciousness and then take a jump, he meant to say that you can't go gradually outside that thing, outside that barrier. You can build up your generalization, yes, everything is matter, and force, and space. You see, time, space, causation, a big sphere. All that's going on inside there is the great samsara, great round of events passing from potential to actual. And here is the limit of the universe. When we've got to that point, we've come, by definition, to the biggest circle we can conceive. Now, if we want to find out what is beyond, first of all, it proves we don't understand the meaning of the word what. Because there is no what beyond. The beyond is a pure negation of everything that we know of inside there. And yet we must ascribe to it the power to cause whatever is inside there. So we have to take everything we know in there, the cabbages and the radishes and the motor cars, and say they're not outside. We negate the particulars, and we say that whatever is outside is not one of those forms, because we define all those forms as inside the biggest sphere we can conceive. So if we want to get absolute awareness, and we don't say consciousness at this point, because if we did we would say consciousness, we would have to say we're talking about integrated forms. We want to get absolute awareness, we must come to the biggest concept we can, the universal, which contains inside itself all particulars, and then we must take a leap into formlessness. Now, Plotinus said of this, this leap, he said, from the point of view of an individual man, is a leap into the dark. But he says, if you leap into that dark, when you leap back again, you will know much more than any individual within the universe. Because in the universe, any individual is circumscribed by his organism. And if you go into there, you have that experience and jump back into it, so you know this plus. And it must be a jump. There's no gradualness. Either the barrier is there, the firmament is there, the circumscription is there, or it isn't. Either you're inside it or outside it. You can't stand on it. It's a highly dynamic twirling perimeter. If you try to stand on that, you get thrown off. So what you do is jump over the definitional band. And that is absolute. Now, you will not stay there in your physical body if you do jump. You jump by a leap of the intuition. By that paralogic, you jump outside the definitional band into the absolute, and you then know that the absolute is not a negative, but a positive, and you prove it like this. Every finite being is limited. By definition, finite. Every limitation is a negation. So inside this big universal sphere, every little sphere is a negation. And if we negate the negation, we get no. We get, it's not, which is the same as it is. So if we negate the negations, we have the absolute positive. The absolute positive contains in itself this universe as one of its modifications, with all the beings in it, and they are effects of it, whatever it is. And therefore, when Christ says, seek first the kingdom of heaven, then all things will be added to you. You won't lose. The kingdom of heaven is this limit, you see. Seek first that, then you've got all things, haven't you? Then, says he, if you go to the Father who sent me, that's him, then greater works than these in Sandusvia shall you do, because that is the absolute. He made all that universe inside every one of us. There is a bit of white paper which is exactly the same qualitatively as what is outside. And when we transcend, go beyond the limits of all definitions, whatever, we come into our absoluteness, and we can then do by free will instead of merely reacting to stimulus inside the universe. And to do this, we have to realize that we're not getting something we haven't got. The white paper is underneath. That absolute spirit there, the absolute positive, is there. And it's because it's there that we can do it. When Christ says, some people say, heaven's over there, that fellow says it's over there, they say, lo here, lo there, but really it's within. Because that power is inside any being, because it is infinite. There is nowhere where it is not. The quickest way to find it is to go inside yourself. Because if you go outside, you're going to the limit where the stimulus hits you. It makes you external in consciousness. If we go outside to our gross physical bodies, our five senses start knocking on us and fill consciousness with their form. That's particular form. We don't want particular form. We want universal form first, and then we want to transcend that definition. That's why before, when I did that little egg and said this is a proof that we are not a tabula rasa, we are full of form. Because outside the universe, the absolute is not static. It is an absolute positive, pure dynamism in absolute actuality, containing all forms whatever. The biggest one that we know about is the universe. But it contains absolute formal actualities as power modalities of itself. That is power, intelligence, behaving outside there, and part of its behavior is the production of this universal sphere inside which we exist.
Is the nature of the life also determined in the egg as well?
Oh yes. You know, one of the oldest things in the world is become what you are.
Yes.
Not become what you're not. You see, suppose we take a rhododendron and decides, I'm going to be the very, very best lily that's ever grown. And it strains itself. It won't become it. You cannot do so. You see, every being is unique. It can carry itself to its term, its norm, its highest level. The norm is not the average. The norm is your top-level expression. Average is way below the norm for anybody. When you reach your norm, you are valuable in the universe, and you are valuable to you because you have become you. Nobody else can be you. Nobody else can do what you can do. They could ape it, or you could ape theirs. They cannot really be it. And therefore, we can see that these little individuals inside the world, their best work is to go inside themselves and find out that which is unique and stop being dictated to from outside by somebody else's bad example. Sometimes you get, perhaps, we'll say, a Yiddish fellow who remembers trouble in Germany, and he doesn't want to be Yiddish anymore. So he changes his name from Levy to Lewis, and he tries to Christianize himself. Nevertheless, he is what he is. And there's always a peculiar something, a discomfort in him. And you find the other fellow who said, I'm still Yiddish. We've been persecuted. And there are good Yids and bad Yids. Well, they're Yids, and I'm a Yid. Well, then he's better off than the fellow who tries to unbecome himself. You find sometimes Negroes in America with their own newspapers, their own universities, a high yellow type with a lot of white blood, maybe they're octoroons, and they're trying to be that last thing, the pure white, and forget that black below. The real black despise them. The real white despise them. And they themselves are climbing up into the pale. You find sometimes Negroes in America with their own newspapers, their own universities, a high yellow type with a lot of white blood, maybe they're octoroons, and they're trying to be that last thing, the pure white, and forget that black below. The real black despise them. The real white despise them. And they themselves are climbing up into the pale band. Now, they feel uncomfortable about it. And they've set themselves a wrong target because of a false value imposed from outside. The value that says that black is bad, white is good, and they've accepted the definition. They should take nothing to do with it. If black is black, then there's a virtue in being black. If black exists, find out what it is and do it. Louis Armstrong plays the trumpet better than Nat Ganella. And Nat Ganella's quite good at copying Louis Armstrong, but he's not Louis Armstrong. He doesn't sound like him. There are certain things that they can do. Nobody can touch them in their own field. And if they're being fully and consciously themselves, say like Paul Robeson, who is aware of himself and he doesn't deny himself, and he takes his talents and uses them to justify himself, well then he's being strong and being himself. And really to be yourself is the same thing as to be strong. To be not yourself is to be wrong.
It can always seem to be divided.
Necessary. Now, let's take a whole being, and we said that one half of him will keep for pure will, or power, and another half for ideas.
Top
half, the top to know what the bottom half is about. Mm-hmm. Not sure whether Mr. Bush has it. Maybe I agree with him. Because he doesn't fit. Without all idea, we
have no will, or all will, then no idea. But
then
the rest, you should
be able to formulate what's going on there. Yeah, well, that's going to take you the rest of your being time.
Or just
that
way, hang on, I'll find
out. You want only to formulate what is applicable in the moment. Yes, okay. You know, sufficient for the day's evil thereof. And the evil means this formulation, you know. Because formulation cuts you off. And therefore it is evil. Really, the pure will is absolutely applicable anywhere, isn't it? But the ideas are only applicable somewhere. And sufficient for the day's evil thereof means don't formulate more of your will than is needed in the situation in which you find yourself. Otherwise you'll have carking care, you'll start worrying yourself about a million possibilities, and you'll go far beyond the formal possibilities of the situation and use energy up in thinking that should be used in the job. So we don't want to formulate any more of that will than we need at a given moment. And we want to gain the power of dissolving ideas into the will whenever we need to. Because this whole thing is the self, and what we want is self-control. We don't want to have to formulate. We want to formulate by will. We don't want to will formlessly, we want to formulate the will at will. So here is the self, and we see that if we take an idea, and that idea defines the form of action, and this supplies the power that will activate that form. Now, of all the ideas, here is another being. We'll put this one upside down. The will of that one is there, and these two are in contact on the level of their superficial personalities. There's idea there. Now, these two people skirmish by discussing their ideas. What they try to find out in discussion is where they stand, as they say. Where the ground of their will is. What is the form that their will take? And so when two people come into contact, the first exchanges are through ideas.
I haven't got one. I probably have here, if they haven't. Oh dear.
Let's thicken this line of the superficial ideas that we use in the interchange with other people. And supposing this person here has an idea that he's a good fellow. We'll say he's a church boy and put a cross on him. And we'll say that the other fellow has got a devil's tail. There's his devil's tail. Now, this fellow doesn't care about what that fellow cares about. But this fellow does care about what this fellow cares about. So when the two meet, this one says, do you belong to the church? Have you taken Jesus Christ as your personal saviour? And he says, what the hell? You see, now he's very shocked and he's not. He's enjoying it because in saying what the hell, he's saying that particular form that you're presenting is nothing to me. And he's saying that form which I'm presenting is everything to me. My will is flowing into that form, and that form is spreading into my will. So if I take all my will and put it into that form will dominate me completely, won't it? So if I become a one-track man, actually if I misunderstand Christ's words, and become a one-track man and say, I'm for the cross, and that's final. And I honestly, in my ignorance, believe that that cross, which I'm for, is the one that Christ meant. And I insist on everybody taking a verbal statement and giving me a verbal reply, yes, I too accept the cross. If they won't do that, then every time I come in contact with a person at the level of my personality, if that person rejects the form to which I have committed myself, I'm going to feel awful. Now, we have the evidence in Christ's behaviour of him saying very peculiar things to people, ambiguous things, and sometimes disappearing from among a crowd of persons so that they couldn't catch him, calmly saying, my time has not yet come, and they can't find him. He shows that he's not going to formulate unnecessarily, nor is he going to put his will in a canal and let it drift in one direction. He'll put his will where he wills it. The Pharisees wanted to establish a form, and he said there's another form. And he deliberately assumed this other form because they were assuming that form to balance it. And he always reminds people that there is always another form, and that all forms derive from a fundamental, the absolute, which produces this God, and that God which produces inside it neighbours. And that you can love those neighbours only if you love that God, so that one comes first. We must realise that when we formulate an idea, if we commit the whole of our will into it, and then the idea is attacked, we are going to suffer. So whatever idea we set up, we should not pour 100% of our will into it, unless the idea is such that nobody can attack it. In other words, the idea of absolute adaptability. That's a good idea. You can put the whole of your will into that. You can put the whole of your will into the notion that all formulations, whatever, are within the circumscribed limit, within definition. We can prove, in a very, very short way, that those things inside that definition cannot exhaust the absolute. We say subject and predicate, don't we? in a sentence. There is always a subject, and there's always a predicate. Exhausts the subject. Predication goes way beyond that, and when you've gone for one, two, three, four minutes, you've got to add them all up again and put them back into A. Because A was the unity principle underlying the predicates. So no amount of predication will give you the key to add it all up again and put it back in the subject. So it demonstrates the logical fact that predication cannot exhaust the subject because it leaves out the unity principle, which makes the subject precisely what it is. It's like drawing an imaginary circle and dividing it like this. And you say, what's that? And somebody says, oh, it's not so glossy diagram. So you see, what it is a circle divided with the circle left out. Now that's like saying that all the predicates are A, with A left out. So that predication cannot exhaust the subject. Now predication is simply saying all the particulars of the universe. So if you say all the particulars of the universe, when you add them up, you've got to put universe back in. And you don't know what that unity principle is. Because prior to all those things was the absolute, which is beyond definition. Because define means limit. Limit is negation, and that is an absolute positive. So, when we say sufficient for the day is the evil thereof, we mean, when you bring yourself from particulars through generals up to the universal, then jump into the absolute. That's pure, unformed will. And then don't think again, if you can manage it, until you get in a concrete material situation. And then look at the situation and let the situation tell you what one's doing. Because it will stimulate you. And you then get a reaction of immediacy instead of one conditioned by memory. You break ancestral memory that way. You gain what is called spiritual immediacy. The absolute always acts immediately. It's underneath there. It's there that it acts. Gravity doesn't act on the earth from the moon and from the moon onto the earth. Every force acts where it is, not somewhere else. So there is no action at a distance. All action is where it is. The absolute is infinite and therefore is everywhere. Therefore inside yourself you have a centre of immediacy. A centre that does not need to consider anything at all in the memory. It just needs to see the situation. If I react immediately to this situation, I don't immediately take my jacket off and roll my sleeves up and get ready to hit somebody, because nobody's looking aggressive at the moment. And to be aware of the situation thoroughly, and then not to be dictated to by your individual memory or by the collective memory of your ancestors, but to see just what is the situation and to feel it, that is immediacy.
That is the point, is it,
to feel it? To feel it, oh yes. You have to feel it because you've only got two modes of knowing, you see. Thinking it and feeling it. And thinking it is what you mustn't do. To get immediacy, you must feel. And you know, we've done this before, we say, this feeling is field consciousness, you see. We'll put the feel in there. Feeling is fielding. If you close your eyes and relax perfectly, you will lose the energies of your body. But if at a certain point you get a slight fear, it means that you are identified with the body and what it meant to you for a few years. And you think it's an essential reference point for you. And it isn't. When you convince yourself that your physical body is not the essential reference point for you, but your feeling is field consciousness of the absolute, and that is your reference, not a point. And that, you do not panic. then you discover that you are able to feel what is going on, just as it is, without dictatorship of memory. You'll actually find that you can feel other people's feelings. Yesterday, Joan came home with a stomachache because she'd been talking to a girl with a stomachache. And she'd forgotten that she'd been talking to a girl with a stomachache, and she thought it was her own. When she was reminded that it wasn't hers, it went away. She'd been feeling out in this sympathetic way. Spiritualist mediums do that quite often. Mm. And they become aware of the field contraction in another person. And then their own organ contracts in the same way and they get the same symptom. And then if they fall into identification with it, they think it's theirs. It isn't. The whole of space is shot through and through with centres of concentration. And if you relax your own body, you can send down anything. You can pick up good ideas and bad ideas from wherever they are, because they're all centres of concentration.
I mean to say that it's the person that was indulging in their spiritual healing, if he identified he'd be liable to get the complaint, would he?
Well, unless he gets rid of it afterwards, yes, you have to. When I'm doing a thing like that, to diagnose what's the matter with somebody, first I have to get it.
Which means identification.
Identification. Yes. First you feel them, and just let their feeling, you stop your own thought process. You feel that person, this is the meaning of sympathy. Mm-hmm. Same feeling. Sympathy doesn't mean crying your eyes out when somebody else trips up. It simply means you feel the same way they feel. Plus your own understanding, so you one up on them. So you feel exactly what they've got. Your own organism then begins to distort, like theirs is distorting, and you feel the focal centre of the distortion, and then you allow it to sink itself in you, because the field always tends to precipitate form. An idea is the centre of the field. Idea is only concreting of the field, growing together.
That's how you're getting at the original will energy.
That's right. So then we can say, oh well, this is formulated so-and-so, the cause of it is so-and-so, and then we say, right, now we relax, let go, it's not mine, I didn't start it. You're doing so-and-so and so-and-so, work upon that and you'll be all right. Now, sometimes a very peculiar thing happens. While you are doing it, it's energy, you see, and energy is not circumscribed as such. It's absolute. So if they've got a contraction in a certain place and you identify with it, as you identify with it, the consciousness, yours and the other person, shares it between them and it becomes less than the other person. Now if you retain it in yourself, it may go from them altogether and you may keep it. So what we do then is banish, the old magical ritual of the banishing. You invoke, call in the symptom, and you banish it. Now you don't want to say go back where you belong. That's the person I had in the first place. What we say is go back to infinity, which can deal with it, being uncircumcised. You see? So we never tell things to go back where they belong. Remember, a few weeks ago we had this case of a doctor who had a patient, a woman, who felt some terrible irritability and depression, and he told her to go home and say, when this feeling came, go back where you belong. And she had a very quiet husband. And when she said, go back where you belong, he suddenly smashed his hand on the table and said, I can't stand it, and rushed out of the house. Now, if she'd have said, go to infinity, you're not mine, it would have come. And he would have carried on being peaceful. As it was, he got a message. She said, go to where you belong. Children are very, very sensitive to things like that, you know. Sometimes the mother gets a toothache, the child gets a toothache. Or the child gets an ache and the mother gets the ache. An ache in the child can wake a mother up out of the sleep in the early stages, before she's found out she doesn't want it. That is when it starts expressing its self-will. You see? As long as it's absolutely dependent on her and she feels necessary to it. You see, she thinks this poor little thing can't live without me. The whole of her sympathy is with it. So if the child turns over, she turns over. If it coughs in the night, she, what's the matter? And she digs it, I'll be like this, you know, do something. But he's not like that, because he doesn't feed it physically, you see. So she stamped on his shin and bent it up and woke him up. Naturally, that is so. A hen listens to the egg. Have you ever seen them do that? They just turn their ear to the egg and listen for the chick inside to start tapping. And then they'll tap from the outside in response.
There's a wonderful film on television, isn't it? You see them, a duckling had just come out of an egg.
Well, that was the one.
Was tapping, listening for the other duckling to come out and tapping back without his mate.
Amazing, isn't it? The Chinese actually use the hen as a symbol of mother sensitivity because of that. Listening to the egg. It's a lovely thought, isn't it? If you take egg as potential, and the hen means spirit moving, you see. The spirit is listening for the potential in you. And waiting for it to actualize. Now, if you keep that hen consciousness in Zen Buddhism in Japan, this hen consciousness is very important. You listen and feel for your own potential. And you're feeling for what you can do. So that when the time comes that you can do something new, you do it. Instead of waiting 25 years and somebody says, do you know what you could have done 25 years ago if you'd have thought of it? You see? Yeah. Be a hen with your own egg. It means listening to your own potentiality. And it's entirely in the feeling. From the practical point of view, you should learn not to think when you don't have to. I never think in between sentences. There's absolutely no process, and encephalograph shows it on my brain, and there's no process going on in me in between sentences of the order of thinking. That means that I actually don't know what I'm going to say next. I only know what I'm saying. Because the thinking process, which is serial, has been stopped by exercise. And it isn't a necessary part of your being. It's a fear reflex that makes you think. Buddhist psychology is quite clear about that. They say the thinking apparatus is the organ of fear. And the proof is very, very simple. If you are omnipotent, you'd say, let there be, and it would be. So why should you think? So if you do have to think, it means you're not omnipotent. Because you think, how can I do this? But if you were all powerful, you wouldn't think, how can I do it? You'd say, let there be. Fiat, breakfast. See? It's tremendously important to realize that your thinking is only the evidence of your fear. The worried man is the thinking man. The thinking man is the fearful man.
To know that you weren't thinking, you have to think about that.
Oh, no, you don't. That's a mistake. Thinking is formulating. You see, you are aware of your field without thinking. A very simple proof is this. If I show you the Union Jack, you don't have to think about it to see what it is, do you?
No.
See, where the blue and the red and the white start, that's where they start. They're what we call data. They're given to you, aren't they? You don't need to think about those. In the same way, feeling is given. It's there. It's the universal substratum of being. Feeling, sentiency. This sentiency, when it mobilizes itself, is called will. When the inertia carries on after the initiation, we call it desire.
Am I to understand that you're sidetracking thinking of the idea of rationalizing it?
What you call thinking is really not buddhic in the sense we talked about before. The buddhi is universal reason. Whereas the manas, the mind, thinks serially, buddhi thinks simultaneously, not serially. And the buddhi itself is only what it is because of the feeling of unity underlying it. It is that feeling that selects what to say next.
And
nothing is serially going on.
And this is intuitional thought.
It is called intuitional thought when you mean that you have been internally intuited or taught within.
And it's coming right down to you then, from your higher
remember what it's like, you see. Here is the sphere of your being, which could well be the sphere of the universe. The whole of that is sentiency, because this is sentiency. That white paper is sentiency.
Yeah.
And this band is no more than the feeling it would be nice to have a band. So that this other band over here, which plays in a different park, can have a different bandstand. You see? Now here's sentiency, and here's sentiency, and here's the bandstand, and here's another bandstand. Now, I've not drawn any thought in there, that's just pure sentiency. And when sentiency mobilizes itself, ripples go all the way through it, and there it's formed. But they're felt simultaneously, aren't they? Not serially.
Yes, I
can you get this?
There's no limit to this, is there?
Can
you get this?
No, there shouldn't
there's
be.
No limit, is there?
It's designed so that there won't be. You see, every motion inside that sphere is inside that sphere at the same moment, isn't it?
Yes.
You don't
so they're simultaneous.
You don't have to consider the speed of ripples.
Well, if you did, you'd be considering them with a very low, slow considerer at the moment. You see, because if you're trying to think with your mind, it's very, very slow. It can't keep up with this stuff. Those ripples pass across there and back again like this. 30,000 times quicker than you can think. And your sphere of being is aware of them simultaneously. You see that? If there is A inside there, an A ripple and a B ripple, they're both inside at the same moment, which we call the eternal now. It's now that they're there. If we want to account for serial presentation, we must have junction and disjunction. We must take another circle outside which touches you and produces a ripple originating from outside and then goes away again, so there's no ripple. And then it comes back and touches you again. So from outside there came a ripple, then no ripple, and then a ripple, and then no ripple, and then a ripple, and then no ripple. That's not simultaneous, is it? It's periodic, of external origin. That's what we call thinking. All that you call thinking is this stuff through stimulation from outside. And it is serial. That is, if you remember your Aunt Maggie, if you've got one, God forbid, you see, if you've got one, you see, nice lady. When you remember her, you start remembering her in a context in which you knew her. And you start remembering serial things about her, don't you? And that serial stuff is not the way to comprehend her and find out what a deeply loving soul she really has. The only way to do it is to get rid of all serial form, that is form from outside yourself. Get back the spherical form that you had before you were an embryo, when you were a nice self-contained egg, and that is your wisdom.
Would this suggest that a person who had not been informed with a so-called education would find this easier work than a person who had attempted to take into themselves a lot of unnecessary ideas, such as these people would convey?
Of course. We take William Blake as an example. One of the most powerful of British thinkers said, thank God I was never sent to school to be flogged into following the style of a fool. And he meant it. Because he was not imposed on with this serial educational process of the three R's. He went inside himself and he found out what was in. Jacob Burma, one of the greatest theosophical mystics in the 17th century, visited by princes and others, had no education at all. Therefore he wasn't cluttered up from outside. If you do get an education, try to get it from a source, at least, that's aware that the universe exists. See? Because for some people, there is no such being. You see, when Hitler imposed an education on those little kids during the Nazi regime, he is imposing on them something that is not universal. You are Germans. First you are Germans, you see. Later on you may be bipeds. First you are Germans. He inverts the order of things. He puts a particular on the top. and allows that possibly there may be a universe, but we're not interested in it. Now this invalidates the whole being internally. We've got to get the thing in the right order. First the absolute, then macrocosmos, the biggest sphere we can imagine, then all subsidiary spheres, sidereal, solar, terrestrial, and political spheres of influence. You see, all those inside, one inside the other, it's the onion. You know, peer Gynt's image, peel the onion, you'll come to reality. What do you find in the middle? When you take off the last skin, you've discovered the absolute and you've lost your onion. Now, remember we said that if you have an idea in there, we've arbitrarily drawn a circle and cut it in half and said this half is will and that half is idea. That's what we call a schematic diagram. It isn't a living biological drawing. It is a scheme. We think this is will and that is idea. Now we're going to do another drawing, and this will be somewhat more biological. The whole field of it is sentiency, which if mobilized becomes will. And the ideas that are in there, we're going to put them all over here as dots. See? And we'll say that those dots are the intersections of ripples from all over. Wherever there's two lines intersecting, there's a dot. And those dots are ideas. They're the product of the intersection of waves of feeling. You see, I do not like thee, Dr. Fell. The reason why I cannot tell. And so on, you see. You get a wave of revulsion and a wave of pleasure. And this wave, intersecting with another wave, each time I went home or something, twirls round at the intersection point and makes an idea. So an idea is already a complex structure. There is no simple idea in the sense of an unanalyzable idea. What is unanalyzable is fundamental feeling. And that feeling causes this waves across itself, and all the intersections of these waves twirl about and make little vortices. And each vortex is an idea, but it's a relation between waves of feeling. And those feelings are simultaneous in that being, and these ideas are in their places. Each idea is in its own place. And if there were no external stimulation, you'd be very wise in your own wisdom. But when external stimulation comes, supposing that intersection has such a form, there's an idea of a triangle. Supposing the form out here is a triangle, and the stimulus comes, it sweeps right through the whole being, but where there's a triangle to resound to it, it responds. Simple resonance. And you say, oh, there's a triangle outside. The only way you know that is because one inside came up when a stimulus came. Now the next one may be a square. So if you've got a square one down here, that one resonates. This we call the citta, the mind stuff. And the stimulus from outside produces a modification called vritti. Now that word vritti itself, you see, I'll put the vowels in for English so we can read it. Vritti itself, you can see tiro, is the law. You see the anagram again, tiro and tura. And t means that little point. So every little rotor like that produces a little point. That's like a vortex in the surface of the sea, isn't it? You'll see a wave run along like that, and another wave bounding off a rock, cutting across it. And just where they intersect, you'll see go. And that's an idea. You see, the idea is not valid except for the waves of feeling, is it? There's no more in an idea than the constituent waves of feeling make it. Ideas can be resolved into their constituent feelings. In the end, you say, I like it, I don't like it. The world is very simple, really. I like it and I don't like it. Complex ideas are merely a lot of likings and dislikings twirling about. The educational system, do you like it or not? Well, that's very complex, isn't it? Whose system? Do you mean education or induction? So you have to start analysing it. When you come down to it, do you like having form imposed on you from outside? And she says, well, if it'll do me any good, yes. What's good? Well, what I want is good. Ultimately, the thing that I want is my best good. On the way to it, I just want what I want. Always trying to want better goods. If it turns out that the absolute is good for me, I'd like a basin of that. And it's when we become absolutely convinced that the absolute is running straight through the lot and can be contacted in us by sensitive feeling, that we say, I think I rather like that idea. That's good. Because it gives us back a unity that we lose if we become intellectualist and 20th century and empirically scientific and disintegrating. Science is crying out. They're saying, where is the great synthesis that will unify the biological, the physiological, the this, that and the other sciences? They haven't got science. So that science is contradicting each other. And they say, where is that synthesis? And the smarter ones of them say, that synthesis is only possible in an individual who can synthesize it. Where is he? And the answer is, he's not in the empirical scientific field. Because if he were, you see, he wouldn't be that man. And so that they say, well, in this new scientific period, we want all the students to be scientific. And the more intelligent say, no, we must have a few studying the humanities, you know. There must be a few human beings among the scientists to coordinate them. Otherwise, they'll go in their little holes and produce marvellous little things, subatomic. Look what I found, you see, but who's going to put them together? That's another fellow.
About this is how is the order introduced into it if it's not thought about? If you've got the lot at once, why doesn't it spring out willy nilly sort of thing?
Because of sentiency. You see, what you call control is a feeling in you that you'll get your shin kicked if you allow so-and-so out. That's all. Because when people don't care if they get their sins kicked, they let it out. Fundamentally, at the basis of everything is this sentiency. Order is simply this. I feel that if I do so and so, I shall get kicked. And if I do something else, I shall receive a pat on the crumpet. And I feel, which I would rather do. This feeling is the basis of the order, because we've just said that order is a rotor again, isn't it?
Yes.
It's that rotor, the rose, in ancient it, to make it green. That rotor is the order, and that rotor is simply a vortex produced by an intersecting of feelings. There is no order other than the product of waves of feeling producing idea systems. Order is only idea, and ideas are only vortical spin centres in the feeling field.
You've got to start operating in a totally different way, though, this way.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, every religion in the world says, whatever you do, don't, do the opposite. It's the only way you can do it. We're upside down. We have to get hold of this. Fundamental sentiency will give us the key. Supposing we say, all right, we love God, that's the biggest sphere we can imagine, and all the parts internal to it, that means human beings. You can't say, I love God and I hate humanity, because they're parts of God, precipitates inside. If you get your big feeling right, get even bigger, I love the absolute. That's really going places. Now, when you get that feeling precipitates the idea. You see, you can't think clearly from the particular end because your feeling is biased to particulars. A man with a private purpose is privated in energy. Private means deprived, privated. You haven't got to be private. You haven't even got to be public. That's too little. You've got to be paralogical, absolute.
I'm trying to say that this is like using
That's the whole purpose of logic. Logic is a critical instrument to destroy form and restore the original field of the form. That's what it was designed for. That's why we say the Logos, that's Christ, cosmic, is the counterstroke to God the Father. He sets up a logical system which allows education to go on within it. And he then equips inside it the particulars to the point where their private purposes private their will. They then become very, very conscious that they're not getting their own way. That's the, when they're convinced of that, they're then called prodigals eating the husks. That is their external, the husks, the outside. You see. Then they say, we will arise and go back to our fathers. Where is he? And they start looking for the middle and throwing the husks away. They get up and go home. They're going from is going back to the Abyssinian. The Tao Te King puts it, Chang Tzu puts it. How is going home, says he? Go nowhere for a change. Always you're going somewhere, now go nowhere. It's the ideal of mystical aimlessness, being a fool for Christ's sake. Everybody's going somewhere, fast, usually with a sandwich with bicarbonate of soda in it. You can do all those things, the little job you've got and so on, within the big feeling, in its context.
It means you're going to speak without considering all the time.
That's right. You see, this serial consideration stops something far superior. Inside the sphere of your being, you have waves going backwards and forwards, producing wisdom. Knowledge isn't the same as wisdom. Knowledge is canal ledge. There's a ledge and it's dangerous. It's a serial presentation of ideas. While you're trying to gather those together and count them up and consider them, sit them together, the whole of your feeling and your ancestors' feelings and cosmic feeling and the absolute feeling is determining which particular ideas shall be presented to you for thinking. Now, supposing you've got a bad motive. Now, that motive is part of sentiency, isn't it? It's a feeling. It's a feeling, I don't want unity with the absolute, please, isn't it? But that is nonsense, isn't it? It's totally unreal. The absolute responds by saying, well, if you don't want that, you think about these nice ideas. And they're all ideas that will get you into trouble. Because you're here for education. So unless you affirm your identity with the absolute and treat everything within the absolute absolutely and immediately, there'll be trouble. And the ideas fed into you will get you into trouble. That's what they're for. Trouble is turam. To get you into that law and twirl you round, and then you still think you'd like to be different. You see? As far as the mechanics of not thinking are concerned, they're very, very simple, but difficult to apply. What you have to do is take an idea and set it up as a control idea. We call it the modification of control. First of all, we set up the sentence, it is possible to stop thinking. And we prove it by examining the sentence. It is possible to stop thinking. Right. It and is are two separate words, aren't they? What is between them? If there was nothing between them, they couldn't be separate. Now, between them, there is not another word, is there?
No.
Right, so it's possible that when you say it is, that between it and is, you weren't thinking. So it's proved that you can actually spend a bit of time not thinking between it and is. Now what you want to do is extend that. Say it and push the is. Don't let it come in. You know that exercise about stop the number that occurs to you. You know, stop counting. Don't hear it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 7s. You see? Can you stop it? Bad mathematicians can stop that one very easily, can't they? Can you stop it? The more you can stop a thought, the nearer you are to your own inherent wisdom. And when you get it, you'll be very glad that you stuck the thought, because it's always better than the thing you were trying to think. It's that that gave Einstein the unifield theory, not the work he did, but failing and getting tired and saying, oh, what the... You see? And when he stopped, the mind chuckled with serial thinking, and when that suddenly came in, why? Not because he'd worked, because he was tired of working.